those 5 years, the 38 through 43, when, you know, my dream job just got turned upside down overnight. It feels like I realized in a moment, like the Spirit of God just like impressed upon my heart, you can't achieve your way out of this. You can only grieve your way through it. And I didn't know how to grieve.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the But I Tell You podcast. My name is Tyler Gorsline, and I serve as the lead pastor of A Seattle Church here in downtown Seattle, as well as the host of our show. And on today's episode, you are in for a treat. We have my friend Steve Ryan Carter coming to us live from outside of Chicagoland, where he serves as a teaching pastor at Forest City Church, in addition to being the former co-lead pastor of Willow Creek Community Church. He is the host of the Craft and Character podcast, where he helps teachers and preachers to be encouraged in both being people who craft excellent messages, but being people who more importantly embody the very things that they preach. Steve is delightful, and he is someone who has gone through a grief journey that we're going to explore together today. And if you enjoy our podcast, would you do me a favor and subscribe wherever you listen, or follow us on social media at But I Tell You Podcast, or even take it one step further and share with a friend. I hope you enjoy my conversation today with Steve Ryan Carter.
Welcome, Steve. Glad you're here.
Tyler, it's so good. Someday we're actually going to meet in a real place and actually get to have a real meal together. But I love how we've been able to connect online over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it was a privilege to get to be on your podcast. Now my turn to get to have you on ours. I have just loved your work. And if you don't know who Steve is, Steve is a pastor. Steve is an author. Steve recently released the book Grieve, Breathe, Receive, Finding a Faith That Is Strong Enough to Hold Us, And he's author of other books, including The Thing Beneath the Thing, which might be one of my favorite titles of a book ever. I think it's fantastic. And I maybe just use it in sermons like, hey, you know, The Thing Beneath the Thing, you know, without giving you that little author note. And a couple other books as well, you know, has quite a story to tell. And I just thought, man, the gift to have you here as someone who has lived through leadership, who has experienced grief in real ways, and wanted to talk about that today. Wanted to talk about the things you've discovered, maybe, you know, what you had heard it said growing up or in your formation or in leadership about grief, and even like what, you know, but I tell you now, that sort of thing. And so, you know, off the top, like, you know, my first question is like, what is just something about you that people wouldn't know? Like, what's like a fun thing? Cause you've said a lot about a lot, but like, what's a fun anecdote about Steve Ryan Carter?
Oh my goodness. That's a good opening question. Man, I would say, I'm in a Coolio music video.
Stop that.
If you remember, I am. Yeah.
Like Gangster's Paradise Coolio. Coolio. Rest in peace.
So he was at the MTV Beach House, and I grew up maybe like 15 minutes from there. And so we'd go out surfing, and then we just got in, and then it was the song 1, 2, 3, 4.
No way.
It was that song. And I brought dice, and I was just playing dice in this video. I don't know why that is the first thing that came to my mind. You're probably like wanting something like really, really deep.
No, that is perfect.
That is the most bizarro moment right now. But I don't think I've ever told that to anyone really. So
fantastic.
For like 25 years. So yeah.
Well, I love it because, you know, one thing that you also do is you have your podcast, right? So about crafting character, talking about the art of teaching and preaching and how to be people who have character while they develop their craft. And I don't know if anything gives you more street character or more street cred than being in a late 90s Coolio video.
That's right.
And I'm just going to say you were, you know, 12 at the time. You were rolling dice as a 12-year-old at the time. Which is funny. So one of the things in your book, Grieve, Breathe, Receive, that I found really compelling as a 38-year-old is you mentioned this kind of prophetic word of sorts that you didn't see coming, kind of use that phrase. You had this friend say to you, hey, you're no longer, you know, in cool rap videos, but you're entering this season of life, 38 to 43, where a lot of hard stuff's going to happen. And this is right on the eve of you stepping into kind of your dream job, you know? And so leading up to that, like, what was your, before you hit all this grief in real life, what would you say was like your understanding of grief or even your experience of it leading up to that point?
To not do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think often I would say I knew how to achieve. I knew how to set goals. I knew how to press and push and go after what I wanted. And I think, you know, part of that is I was a basketball player. You know, I knew I wanted to play college basketball. That's what I wanted to do. There was like a discipline and a commitment. And so like when I set my mind to something, it was to achieve. And
yes.
when I found myself, walking through, you know, that those 5 years, the 38 through 43, when, you know, my dream job, just got turned upside down overnight, it feels like I realized in a moment, like the Spirit of God just like impressed upon my heart, you can't achieve your way out of this. You can only grieve your way through it. And I didn't know how to grieve. I didn't know how to slow down and actually feel the sadness, name what had happened. And it almost had been like 38 years of just stacking grief that had turned to grievances. And, you know, because we kind of grew up in this age where if we cried and I was a tender kid, if I cried, shame was coming my way.
Wow.
So like in our subconscious, it's like, you don't feel.
Yeah.
You get love when you perform and you win on the court or in the classroom or when other parents talk good about you. You get shame when you are sensitive as a guy and you are tender. And so you learn right away, whether it's through middle school kids or your own parents, don't feel, achieve. And so that's, I think for me, the gift of is learning that achieving is great. That's great. But learning to grieve is actually a more wholehearted, healthier, Jesus kind of lived theology way of living.
Yeah. Wow. It's, it'd be unique if it were just professional, right? And I think that's what was unique, and spoiler alert for the book, but you had personal grief too, right? Outside of the walls of work. And I know how integrated it all is, but just even, it sounds like, you know, part of the grace of God, maybe even the mercy of God is like teaching you what you could not learn on your own or would refuse to receive as someone who is seeking to achieve all the time. And so, yeah, what would you say about even the discovery of kind of the compounding grief, you know, not just in one situation, but in multiple all at once?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it was 2018 when I resigned from Willow Creek Community Church, and there had been allegations about my mentor, my spiritual father in many ways, that were really horrific and sad. And then 8 months later, my earthly father, my adopted dad, dies. And so it's like in a matter of a year, I feel like I lose both my spiritual father, I lose my earthly father. And I had never really known my biological father. And actually, when I was born, I was given the name Stephen Charles Bourne. And Charles Bourne was the name of my biological father. And I came to learn that before my dad died, my stepdad died, I came to learn that my biological father had like signed papers that he thought he was giving up child support, but he was actually signing over me being adopted. And my mom had remarried, and I had always thought he had left me, which reinforced this achievement mindset of like, you got to be so good so people don't leave you. And when Charles Bourne's widow, my biological father's widow, she reached out to me and began to share more of the story, I was like, I don't have a container to put all of this in. Like my three dads right now, I don't know what to do with all of this. And that's where the biblical framework of Holy Weekend really pastored me through and helped guide me through how to actually handle this in a way that honored the text and really honored what comes up when change shows up.
Yeah, it's remarkable to think about how, you know, what is in human terms impossible to actually hold, you know, as a container. You know, you're talking about death, burial, and resurrection, and even that word from God that you heard. I'd love to hear about that and how that even drove the journey and was a point of reflection for you. But you know, it's interesting even hearing you say that, like, man, whether it's the disciples grieving their lost savior or it's us having three father figures in your case, you know, kind of disappear within, you know, a short period of time, and or the realization of the loss, it is too big to contain or hold ourselves, it would seem. And so, yeah, tell me about that word that you received even in the midst of all this.
Yeah, so I remember the day after I resigned, I went to Madison, Wisconsin with my family, just because we had had news cameras at our house and reporters. And so I just knew we had to get away. And so I woke up early the next morning and I just went for a walk. And, you know, Tyler, one of the things I really appreciate about you is like you have this like heart for the Holy Spirit and formation, and you and I track and so many of these same streams. And I just found myself just asking the Lord for a word.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear anything. And so I'm like walking downtown Madison and I just had resigned. I don't know if a paycheck is coming. I don't know what I'm going to do. It's all like my cortisol is like pumping through my body. And I take out my journal and I like read this prayer called the Cadet's Prayer, hoping that maybe God might whisper something to me, and nothing. And finally I sit across the Capitol building and I just say, Lord, please.
Yeah.
And I've probably had this moment, I don't know, a dozen, 15 times, but this strong impression, I'm not saying it was audible, but it felt like it just captured me. And I just heard the words grieve, breathe, receive. And I went to a coffee shop, donut shop, and I just wrote, I have to grieve what is, grieve what I thought it was going to be, grieve how key people let me down. I need to breathe in new mercies. I need to exhale all bitterness and resentment. And I need to receive what I need to learn, receive what I need to own, if anything, and receive who Christ wants me to become in spite of all of this. And I'll never just forget the kindness of the Lord, because again, being someone who needs goals, who needs a map, I felt like God gave me a map that just said, okay, here's the marching orders. You're going to grieve, breathe, receive. I didn't know what it meant. And, you know, a few months later, I have the moment of you can't achieve your way out of this. You can only grieve through it. And I had my journal out and I felt like God said, go to the desert and wait for instructions. And because for me, I wanted to go to somewhere bigger, somewhere that I could be like, this all makes sense. This is all worth it. Like, and God was saying, no, I need you to go and actually process and wander and heal. And that actually led our family to move to Arizona, where my wife was from. And I just found myself getting really connected to the desert mothers and fathers and really rediscovering this Holy Weekend framework that really helped me on my grief journey.
So many things stand out to me from what you just said. And one, you know, you were starting to say about that kind of mix of God meeting you in the contemplative and a word from God, listening to you. It's interesting to think about how, you know, you're asking God, I want a word. And a lot of times even before the situation goes down, like you're anxious and you're going, God, tell me how this is going to be. Like, tell me how it's going to be okay. And give me all the reassurance and the uncertainty. And just thinking about that phrase you use of like the mercies of God, like the steadfast mercies never ceasing and how unique it is that it was in the midst of it. Like, it wasn't like, hey, don't trust me, I'm going to make sure you don't have to trust me, but rather after you've trusted me and you're in it and you're going, what have I just done? What am I doing? And him really meeting you in that kind of, it's the Jesus had faith to give himself, like he actually did, and trusting of the Father and the Spirit and going off of the word there is so compelling to me. And how those mercies, you know, are made new every morning, not just like this one word for eternity that'll be very clear to you, you know, or going out into a desert where it's barren and strange and weird. You had this line that I heard you say recently about, you know, walking in the desert, or even the Eugene Peterson, every theology has a geography, but it made me go like, you sound like a runner, like in terms of not just like avoiding grief, you know, growing up, or avoiding it like at all costs, like just achieve, but even in general, like someone who is a high speed leader, who is an accomplisher, an achiever, and yet you're having to not just go into a new terrain, but learn how to walk slowly in it. And just curious about that, like the crazy shift of pace that I think many leaders are terrified of, which is like, if I were to leave my life in this, or I were to not be in my position or not have influence or not have control, would I die? You know, like if I had to go to the desert and actually walk with God there, would I die? And the fear and the grief, the fear of that grief. Do you have any thoughts, anything you'd share on that?
Well, I mean, I think that, I talk about how like 38 to 43 is five of the most difficult years in a person's life. And I think in many ways it's because you're getting to the tail end of first half of life energy and ambition. And oftentimes, what's really, really difficult, for women and men is I'm not as far along as I thought I would be financially. My energy is starting to go down. I thought I would be at a certain place. Certain desires are different. You experience a typical loss of a parent or a loved one, usually, like oftentimes in those 5 years. And then you're moving into the second half of life. And yeah, I think for many men, you see midlife crises happen. And so in some ways, I found myself going, oh my goodness. Like I, this is affecting me on an identity level. Cause the way that people would talk about me is, hey, I'm really excited Steve Carter's here. He's the former lead teaching pastor at Willow Creek Community Church. Like my best days are behind me.
Yeah.
I also don't have like, a day-to-day job. So I remember when a Home Depot guy was coming to deliver a new washer and dryer to our townhome that we were renting. And I was home on a Tuesday or Wednesday in the morning. And I felt this like pressure to share with this guy. I do work. Like almost to prove my existence.
Productive. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I was like, what is going on? So you had this identity piece. You also had the detox, and the detox off of a 25,000 person church, an auditorium that's at 7,200 seats, like teaching regularly, leading, being able to make decisions, being one of the people in a room that got to lead and discern where God was going. Like, do I ride my bike to Starbucks today? Like, what do I read? Like I had no routine and I had no coach telling me what my routine was. Whereas this is the meeting you need to be at. This is what you have to do. The elders need you here. Like it was, I'm having to create that. And that was really tricky. I think the other piece was, to your point, going slow seemed like death. And it actually is.
Yeah.
It was a death to self, and it was a death to the production. It was, and I typically talk about how, like, when you think about spiritual formation, you can say that really there are the three S's to spiritual formation. It's we have these simple truths like God is with me, God is for me. And then that simple truth finds itself into a struggle or a season of suffering. And you ask yourself, does that phrase, God is with me, God is for me, that simple phrase, does it actually hold up in the adversity and in the fire?
Yeah.
And when it does, that simple phrase is no longer simple. It becomes profoundly and wildly sacred. And when someone says, oh, God is with me, they say it in a different way because it is a lived and an embodied theology that they've experienced, not just something that they talk about. It's something that they've experienced, a God who is worthy of trust showing you and showing me. And so I think that was part of it was, oh, slower isn't the enemy. The slower way is actually a more healthy way. And it doesn't mean I don't still achieve and I don't set goals. I feel like I've been able to frame it in a way that is more in line with the kingdom and a healthier pace that's rooted in grace and in peace and the way of Jesus, not in just a way of production and achievement.
Man, there's so much about that that stands out to me. One is just the nature of how many of us leaders, and mainly pastors, feel called to ministry because of the deep pain we've experienced and encountered. And in some ways it feels like, oh, I feel really alive here in spite of the pain or the thing that I've been grieving my whole life, upbringing, you know, those things. And then all of a sudden there's like a reward to overfunctioning and being unhealthy and being folks who, oh, you're rewarded for avoiding grief, like it feels like in the pastoral call. And yet it's really just procrastination, it would seem. It's really just pushing it down the field until you have a big fallout. You know, either you kind of blow up your life or you, encounter real suffering because it is inevitable. And, thinking about, you mentioned John 20 in your book and just kind of the idea of the upper room. And I've been reflecting on my own journey as a pastor that, I spent like 7-8 years planting our church and never grieving because Sunday kept coming. And I had to bless everybody on the way out because that's the right thing to do. No matter what, you know, I had to be a nice guy. And how much of that took a toll. And in some sense, I felt like I was cowering in the upper room, just like afraid of both resurrection, like, and death at the same time. Like, just don't make a mistake. Just kind of, you know, don't feel hurt again. Don't feel the pain again that you felt when you were younger. And so when you think about leaders and you think about the reasons that they push back on receiving grief or the reasons that they just like want to avoid it, you know, what kind of trade-offs do you see happening there? Like what kind of both maybe reasons we avoid it or maybe costs of avoiding it, you know, things that you see?
I think that I had to ask myself why for the last 20 years have I done counseling on Monday mornings at 11 a.m.? You know, and I realized, oh, I do this because for me, it gives me the most amount of time to open myself up and put it all back in a box before Sunday.
Before the next Sunday.
Yeah. And it was like this in my subconscious. I thought, oh, that just makes sense. But then I realized like, oh, this is why I've been doing this, which I think leads to the next piece is I think for many of us, we have this illusion of control and we feel like we want to protect ourselves as leaders to never be surprised and to never be out of control. And when we actually have to lean into grief, we're afraid of where those feelings and that sadness is going to take us far out of our control with Sunday coming. And so I think we end up just not choosing that posture. We think we can manage it. But the truth is rent will be due on that grief.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to pay for it at some time. And sometimes that payment's going to come at the hand of some destructive patterns because you haven't faced the grief. And you now have to really pick up a bunch of collateral damage. The other is like, sometimes it's just, you're not like safe as an employee, as a boss. You're not the kind of leader. You have all this unforgiveness. You have all this bright siding. You have all this anger that's just, and people don't want to be around it. It's not compelling. And I think for me, I had to almost Jedi mind trick myself to deal with grief, because I didn't want to deal with it for myself. But someone asked me once, how do you know you're a good parent? And I said, I think you're a good parent when your kids go to counseling for different reasons than you go.
Yeah.
Which means you didn't pass something down to them that was given to you, but you're going to give them something. And what I realized was, if I don't, and my wife and I don't choose to engage this grief, what are we teaching our kids?
Wow.
Don't acknowledge it, which is what I had been taught.
Yeah.
And so for me, that became something to go, well, let's just start reading the Psalms. Let's just start seeing that grief is all over. Lament is all over. Confession is all over the scriptures. And let's start being more comfortable experiencing a God who is safe and consistent, worthy of trust, who can really help guide us through it.
Wow. Yeah, that's such a unique thing to consider, is, you know, it's hiding in plain sight, much the same way both our grief, it would seem like it's there. And it, you know, what I hear you saying, and I've laughed about the counseling thing, because I'm pretty convinced that the things I'm worried about my kids going to counseling for, my behavior, it's going to be some other thing that they're going to be like, dad was this. And I'm like, that was the thing. But I think that, you know, this kind of integrity piece of, it feels like, you know, kind of consistency, inner consistency and outer, like inner and outer consistency. You're the same person wherever you are, which means that, I think it's Rohr who says the whole, like, whatever is not transformed will be transmitted. And this element of, it's got to go somewhere. And that's what I hear you saying, is like, it's got to go somewhere. And unfortunately, a lot of times we're rewarded even with spiritual formation, this idea of like, if I can just keep it going up and to the right. And instead, it seems like there's a deeper invitation to let the seed fall to the ground. Or even, you know, Jesus talking to the disciples about when they're old, they're going to be led in a way that is not by their own control and their own power. And so it feels like God is preparing us for to die well. Like, grief is like this long preparation to enter the kingdom, you know, and be resurrected. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm curious what you would say. You kind of would say now, you know, but I tell you, like, you've thought it was a certain way, you'd heard it said it was a certain way, but like, what would you say to folks now? Like, but I tell you, grief is like this.
Yeah. I would say that, you know, I once would tell you, don't grieve. That's what was my lived embodied experience. But now I would tell you, grief with hope is one of the greatest gifts that the kingdom of God offers us. It's this reality that, you know, Friday, we are in grief. If you look at the Holy Weekend, Saturday, known as Silent Saturday, or in the Hebrew scriptures, was like the desert season, the wilderness, the 40 years in the wilderness, is that almost belief that I can get through this. I can just get, we start bargaining. We look for ways to just to get through it. And some of us, we do that in destructive ways, and it's all about our relationship with waiting. But then when you get to John 20, you see Jesus showing the holes to Thomas. And I love that, because what it shows me is post-resurrection, the surprise of Easter, it's almost as if Jesus is now still with what he experienced on Friday. He's just carrying it differently. And so it's this movement of going in grief, through grief, but then carrying and living with this grief, but you're living with it differently. And for any leader, what you have to know, you've got to be able to ask yourself in any given moment, what day of the week am I in? Am I in Friday right now?
Wow.
Like, dude, am I in Saturday? And if you're in Friday, you've got to hold out to say 1 Thessalonians 4, I am in Friday, but I'm not going to lose sight that Sunday's coming. And for some of us who are more optimistic in nature, that we struggle with naming a Friday or Saturday, we just want to just bypass the desert, get to Sunday as quick as possible. That's beautiful that you're a person of hope. But the reason you can have the most amount of hope and the reason Sunday came is because Friday happened. And so you have to name Friday. And I think as a leader, what I've had to understand is in Romans, when Paul writes, we mourn with those who mourn and we rejoice with those who rejoice and everything in between. We are people who are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We can hold it all because we understand that God is holding us and will never leave us or forsake us.
Come on, man. What a gift it is to even have permission in that. You know, it sounds like it's okay if you are, say, you know, you're Resurrection Sunday optimist to embrace lamentation and to embrace the parts of the scriptures you mentioned earlier that are wrought with at best a defiant hope, at, you know, honesty, I'm not sure I can hope, you know, and then, you know, in the kind of Good Friday experience, or those who are, you know, rejoicing and, you know, Easter has come, you know, the greatest news that God has overcome the grave, that, you know, or in the stuck and the waiting in between, and to not either bypass it or to bright side it or to, you know, even wallow in it. Cause I think at times, like, it feels like forever, but Jesus is like, well, yeah, maybe the wounds are, as you showed the hands, you know, like the wounds go with you, but you're able to, you know, still find resurrection. This defiant hope is still there for you.
Well, and I think to the other piece is when you actually do this and do this work, you actually get to embody what you preach. And you, by doing this work of naming and understanding Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in your own story, you become profoundly empathetic to other people who are entering into their Friday or struggling to believe that Sunday's coming, or who are walking through the holy uncertainty of silent Saturday and the desert. Like you have this empath because you know what that's like and you know how God met you.
Yeah.
And so the character and empathy piece, the integrity piece to say, I don't just know this stuff, but like I'm actually leaning into it, is one of the greatest gifts of the grief journey, of how you will experience God in a just more deeper and profound way.
For those two groups of people come to mind. One, the person, the leader who says, I don't know how. Like, I'm actually with you, Steve. I would love to, like, learn how to grieve, but I've never learned how. Like, any sort of kind of pointers in a direction, even, you'd say, hey, this might help you go towards learning how to experience and, you know, embody, encounter your own grief. And then maybe the second person is someone who says, but I don't have time for that because I got too much on my plate already, like, as if it's optional. As if it's something they, you know, can somehow keep holding it all together without navigating, you know? So yeah, what are kind of some ways you'd encourage people towards it, or like practical steps they could take to start to encounter even grief?
Yeah. I think I would start, if you're very, very new to even the process of sitting and holding space for your own sadness or experience, I do this practice typically on a Sunday night or a Monday morning. And it comes out of that verse, you know, guard your heart, for through it all things, you know, will flow out of. And I think we do a good job of guarding a lot of stuff. We guard our, you know, Instagram login. We guard our bank account information, social security number. I don't know how many of us guard our heart. And so I have this practice where I just almost look at the last 168 hours of the past week, because we all have that, and I play it back. Was there a moment where something happened that, man, it was just hard. It was just difficult. It was just sad. And I just kind of like watch the game tape. I just like replay it, maybe journal about it. So you just start by playing it back. Just look at a moment from the past week, maybe a meeting, maybe a conversation with your wife or your husband or your kids. And then I start to play it out. And I imagine Jesus in this moment, because you're going to probably be in a similar situation again. I imagine Jesus almost just saying, all right, how do we handle this in a way that where we have the same mindset of Christ? How do you handle this in a way that you literally can have this lived theology that's like more grounded in a cruciform life? What would it look like for you to handle that differently? And I just write about that because I know someday I'm going to be in that situation again. So I play it back. I play it out. Third, I play it honest. And part of that honesty is most of us leaders, we're moving so fast. We have a hard time like actually connecting to the feelings that we are having. So how are you doing? Good. What's going great? You know, it's the mission of the church, the vision. We're up and to the right, da da da, giving's good. Like, but we don't necessarily know how to like talk about what's happening with us. To play it honest means I can name what is happening and stirring in my heart. And then lastly, play it smart. And play it smart means just if I got to guard my heart, part of it is what am I doing to pour good life, soul-filling, wholehearted, restorative energy into that heart? And I have to look at my schedule and go, okay, what do I have in the coming week that's going to be just for my heart? It's just for my heart, mind, body, and soul. So that's been one little practice. If you're new to it, I'd say that. Second is ask your spouse and ask maybe two close friends who've known you for a while and just ask you, hey, is there anything in my life that you think I'm avoiding?
Wow.
You ask your spouse that question. And she or he, hopefully will give you just a clue that maybe that will just give you a chance to make space sometime, maybe a Sabbath morning or a Monday morning or just a walk walk with the Lord or a trusted counselor or a mentor that just to bring that before. But I would just go slow as we were talking before. For many of us, we don't have the muscle of the spiritual muscle to lean into grief. And I think sometimes if we just try to open that wound, it can be so overwhelming. So be kind to yourself, be wise, but be intentional and recognize you can't do it alone. You're going to need some good people in your life. So yeah, a practice and maybe a question to ask.
It's beautiful. And then if you had anybody that was saying, hey, there's just not, I can't, I got too much on my plate, would you just say, well, then that means you need to do it? That's like exactly, or in that kindness and in that, you know, invitation to say, hey, maybe you're flooded with cortisol and deadlines and expectations and, you know, just perceptions. But, you know, but I tell you from experience or from, you know, what I've learned interviewing leaders about how they maintain character, you know, what would you say?
Man, I think if you actually looked at every leader that has fallen, they probably gave you a similar answer.
Yeah.
I don't have time. And you have to understand that I think pace contributes to destructive patterns. When you are at a unhealthy pace and capacity, and that's just now going to create pressure that you have to maintain. That is, and you're redlining. And in that red line, it's only so long that you're going to be able to go where you don't either burn out and or emotionally lose it or physically choose some unhealthy escape. You know, and so I think you have to ask yourself, do you think that you are actually wiser and more capable than any of the leaders who have fallen? And this really gets to really is it your success that's leading the way? Or is it, do you want your character to lead the way? My buddy, Sean Marshall, who's a pastor at Salem Baptist with Dr. Charlie Dates. He says, man, I don't want people just to learn how to preach well. I want people to finish well.
Yeah.
And I think that is at the heart of, man, at the end of the day, I just want to be a man of integrity and character for my kids, for my congregation. I've had to really wrestle this down to the ground. I'm not saying it's easy, but I had to really wrestle my own ambition, and I had to really wrestle my own pace down to the ground to say, at the end of the day, who do I want to be? Like, so what that you gained the whole world, but you lost your soul? Like, so what that you preached to all of these places and you built two more campuses, but your kids don't want to be around you? So what? Like, at the end of the day, and I think we've kind of, many of us in our 30s and 40s and maybe even early 50s, I think we were taught, well, the good outweighs just some of the difficulty that you're going to have to go through. The good outweighs that you're doing outweighs the pain that you're bringing to your family. The good outweighs the pain you're bringing to your staff. And I'm just here to tell you, it's not. It's really not. And it's not the Jesus way. Can I tell you one other random story?
I am loving this. So please.
Oh, okay. So in 2017, I had the chance to go to the Vatican to meet Pope Francis, and I got invited. It was really, really great. And the night before, we met with his social media director, which is just awesome to me. And this guy is like a Catholic historian. And so we're having this amazing meal, and he says, hey, do any of you have questions about Catholicism and about the Vatican? And there's a group of us, and no one asks a question, and I'm dumb enough to ask
like
one.
Somebody's got to, we can't leave them hanging. I'll find curious about.
So I'm like, hey, and this is before I knew anything of what was happening at Willow. This was just because of a show on Showtime. But I said, hey, I feel like you've had some really well-known and thoughtful, theologically sound popes. And you've also had some popes that weren't really, really great. How do you tell your story where you don't try to dismiss or forget or move on from the Pope Borgias, who bought the role, who had kids, who were just not a version of what you would want from a spiritual leader? And I'll never forget this, Tyler. He says this. He goes, no, we don't. But what most people don't understand is that out of every bad pope that we've had, a new order was created. So out of Pope Borgia, the Jesuit order was created. And it just dawned on me maybe a couple of years ago when I was in the desert just journaling, I had this moment to go, you know what I think is happening right now? Is this new order of character and formation that has, I think, even in our evangelical, non-denom, in our church world, where power and privilege and resources and money and pace has just gotten us to drift from the heart and the way of Jesus, that there is this clarion invitation back to practicing the way, to being a woman and man of character and formation and really embodying the cruciform life. And that means that you have to actually look at the stuff that's happened to you so that you don't transfer and transmit that on somebody else, which means you get to be someone who embodies a life of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, someone who's in grief, but is someone who recognizes, yes, Friday happened, but so did Sunday. And I believe if it happened for Jesus, it will happen for me as well.
Man, what a word. And thank you for your time. I just, with that, say, you know, I, listening to you there, just feel like there's the seed falls to the ground and yet the gates of hell won't prevail. And God is determined to set us free, it seems, through grief and through resurrected life on the other side of it. You know, that he's determined to be the author and finisher of our faith. And that's a joy set before him. And so, it's a joy for me to have had you on the podcast to, get to do what you do for all your guests, which is just say what a blessing you are and your ministry. And, you're such an encourager. And I know that myself and whomever is going to get to listen to this is going to be so encouraged by a more beautiful vision for following Jesus as a leader and walking with him through grief and in grief and out of grief and all of that, you know, Friday to Sunday experience, in a good, healthy way. So thanks for being with me, Steve. It's been great to have you, and I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Tyler. The love is mutual, and just so proud of who you are and the way that you shepherd and pastor and the way your character is leading the way, man. Much, much respect for you.
If folks want to catch up with you, follow you, how do they find you?
You go to stevecarter.org or on Instagram or Threads or Twitter. It's @SteveRyanCarter.
Awesome. Thanks, Steve.